Hey everyone, welcome to Life, the University, and Everything. This is the podcast of mostly academics sipping, spilling, brewing, and hopefully icing a little bit of tea while discussing life's biggest questions. I'm your host, Kat Gonzalez. I'm here today with Aldis Petrichaks, a research assistant at Stanford University. Aldis has been here the past couple years, being a research assistant, and also you can find his writing on Palo Alto Online. But today we're talking about generally community, belonging, and a little bit of suffering. Like I said, Aldis is currently at Stanford, but he's actually heading to Harvard Medical School in the fall. So that's really exciting, and here at the podcast, we wish him the best in his career and also his writing and thinking endeavors. So with that, let's hand it over to me and Aldis.
Well, so I'm super interested in this question this season about cultural identity and intersections.
Okay.
I know we've somewhat talked about it in our own personal conversations a little bit, but I wonder if you could describe your sense of identity growing up and how that was formed.
Yeah.
And how you navigate the space now in your adult life.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I think a little background for me, my dad, his parents are both from Latvia, which was, kind of part of the Soviet Union until the wall fell. But they ended up moving. My dad was born in Venezuela. His father, after World War II, ended up kind of moving there to do work. And then he was raised in kind of upstate New York, and, from early age. My mom immigrated from Taiwan after college, but her parents were from mainland China. They came over when kind of Mao took over in the Communist Party in China. You have this and both my parents had previous marriages prior to marrying one another and everything. They met in the Bay Area in their early 30s, both computer engineers. And so kind of growing up, I think, both sides of my parents' family were very well, I think, acquainted with displacement and, coming from mainland China to Taiwan to America, or from Central Europe to South America to America, and so in my house there was not a lot of coherent, we're a Chinese American family, or we're Latvian.
Right.
I didn't speak either of my parents' languages growing up, their native languages, and so there wasn't a huge amount of internal coherence in the household. I definitely had some identification and kind of appreciation for Chinese heritage and European heritage and stuff, but I found that because of that, for most of my life and even to this point, cultural or whatever ethnic identities really did not play a large part in my self-concept. It ended up really being shaped by, I think, things values or just the way social circles I ended up being in.
What sort of social circles did you frequent growing up?
Yeah. An interesting part, going back to not being in kind of one internal coherent thing, was that I was always one of those kids who was very, had its feet in a lot of different social circles, but perhaps didn't feel totally immersed in anyone. So basketball for most of my life still was, the essential identity factor. So I was always hanging out with my teammates and everything, very immersed in that culture. But I would also just have friends who knew absolutely nothing about sports, so that I would just meet in some classes or whatever, and I would have very, very close friendships with them. And oftentimes, these circles that I was inhabiting did not cross over one another a ton, so I'd kind of be bouncing back and forth.
They weren't intersecting.
No, not a lot, at least in early portions of my life, and still at some point in where I am now,
Yeah, how would you describe your social circles now
and
different intersections or not?
There's probably, obviously you can't perfectly, it's never works in your perfect, like, abstractions, but there's definitely a group of my groups of friends who say who I have from high school and college, who largely my high school friends, the ones that I really still kind of value, came from, you know, basketball and mm-hmm. you know, guys I would play with. They're also like, you know, we had a lot of kind of other intellectual similarities and stuff. Mm-hmm. In college, it was like a lot of people, it was mostly people who I lived around near, you know, my early college days.
Yeah.
Who also were like me, kind of very locked in and focused on their studies, mm-hmm. things like that. Mm-hmm. So that ended up being kind of a mix of proximity and temperament, mm-hmm. Type thing. And then there's also, you know, last couple years, for the first time, really trying to think about, you know, the intersection of like my faith and my social relationships, particularly as it pertains to like, say, Christian community and things like mm-hmm. that. So mm-hmm. there's also now kind of a big pocket of people I've met, you know, at Stanford within mm-hmm. like the graduate student Christian community, things like that. And then there are probably people who I met in the kind of professional setting, you know, at the med school and in the work, you know, in the division I was doing.
Yeah. Growing up and both now, like, mm-hmm. what's your sense of belonging in mm-hmm. these different spaces? Like, how do you experience the world going back and forth between these different circles?
Yeah. It's tough to, I guess, like, I feel like I belong in all of them and that I feel very well kind of like appreciated and valued in all of them, mm-hmm. In an authentic way. But again, I think there's some sense of like parts, it almost feels like parts of me kind of come out, you know, in each different circle. Mm-hmm. So in my college friend circle, there's like a lot of, you know, a lot of that kind of like silliness and goofiness mm-hmm. combined with that like intense tendency to like lock into my mm-hmm. passions and ideas, because they were all around me when I was, you know, doing my studies and whatever.
Yeah.
And in my like kind of basketball friends, that's where, you know, you saw an even greater side of that like totally unrestrained, like, you know, laughable, kind of silly kind mm-hmm. of personality stuff, mm-hmm. but probably less of the, you know, sharing of vocational passions and whatever. Mm-hmm. And then on like the Christian side, right, there's like a tremendously deep sharing of that like internal, you know, experience of the world and the like spiritual side of things and other pockets too. But because, you know, in those groups, I'm not kind of bringing so much of my, say, like, work life, or I'm not living, I haven't lived kind of with any of the people I work with or I see in like these Christian circles. Yeah. There's other sides of me that don't come out as much. Mm-hmm. So in all of them, I feel like kind of, you know, there are genuine parts of me that are very well known to the mm-hmm. people and accepted and valued. But in few circumstances, have I seen it kind of all, you know, all, immersed, right, every part of me
come together,
and usually when it does happen, it's in individual, like very rare kind of individual relationships mm. where someone sees you enough and knows you enough mm. that, you know, they've now in some sense at least heard or been exposed to like all those aspects.
Mm. Yeah, so do you feel like you go about life like looking for those rare mm. spaces where those can align sometimes, or mm-hmm. yeah, or have you been okay with that so far, or what's mm-hmm. that sort of existential going on?
Yeah.
Because you and I talk about just like what is home, what is mm-hmm. belonging.
Yeah. There's this author, Thomas Wolfe, who wrote in like the early 20th century, and I was reading mm-hmm. his books like kind of late 2018, early 2019, and you know, there's a lot in there that I didn't kind of identify with or didn't seem to make mm-hmm. sense in my life, but his mm-hmm. his books really had these like vivid themes of like a young man kind of mm-hmm. trying to feeling the world in an incredibly like vivid and powerful way, and having all these like this desire to just kind of take in all the like kind of magic and beauty and, you know, fascination and wisdom that has to offer. But then almost as a result of that, like deep drive, feeling somewhat like alienated or just outside of it, because you can never kind of like grasp everything that there is to kind of offer. And so that wasn't even the answer to your question, but going back to your question, I think I realized that it's pretty like, you know, that ideal of like a relationship or a community or something where like every single aspect of yourself is like fully revealed and like valued and brought into like the relationship or the community, that's actually like a lot of our ideals, you know, perhaps somewhat unrealistic again, because like our ideals are constructed from what we see in like our day-to-day lives, right? So we see like, okay, in this relationship, like I can bring this part of myself, you know, in this relationship in the work context, I can bring this part of myself. And then you take like, you know, those pieces of all those different contexts, and then you put like a mental construct together where they're all together. And the question is like, does that mental construct actually kind of exist in the real world? So I think I was kind of like anyone probably desiring of those situations if they came along would be like, wow, this is, you know, really incredible. But actually part of what I had to do, I think, to start to feel a bit more comfortable was not expect any one relationship or community to like be the perfect version of it that I wanted to be, that I could feel most at home. And perhaps, you know, that was something I had to do more in my own self and, you know, being okay with my own self. And, you know, particularly as it pertained to my faith as well, there's a thread that tied through there.
So maybe what I'm hearing is like a combination of expectations and the ideals. Like, do you feel like, say maybe people like you and I, we have, like the issue is expectations and ideals, or do you feel like there is some more magnified sense of like alienation from like these big, like thinking about these big questions and then like wondering, are people asking this themselves, or are they already feeling at home? Like, are those coming together for them? Is there something up with that?
I think it's a little bit about, so I think it's part of it, you know, when like I felt more not at home or not belonging, part of it is the tension of thinking that my ideals kind of perfectly exist in the real world and that I have to constantly compare like my real interactions with them. That's part of the tension, but I do think, that there is also the sense, kind of when like you're interacting with other people or you're in these communities, that there may be something else that kind of like perhaps comes between people, either between two individual people or between one person and like the setting that they're in. So for example, I in my writing, there was like one of the essays I most enjoyed writing over the past year was this kind of one on loneliness, which was something that I think I struggled with probably towards the end of like 2018. And I think part of the thing that I realized in reflecting on it was that a big part of the propagation of that like feeling of loneliness, like a lot of the propagation of any like insecurities, is this kind of deep vulnerability it touches on, kind of in us, namely like the insecurity, the vulnerability that we might not be recognized or like valued or kind of known to other people, and then that insecurity kind of shielding us from that insecurity, not wanting to reveal itself to other people, even though like the revealing of that insecurity might be kind of a big part of the key to solving like the problem itself. So again, you have like two lonely people, say, and like, you know, they would both want nothing more than to like kind of reveal their loneliness or whatever to like another person, and then the other person to be like, yes, me too, oh my gosh, wow. And not in some like cheesy way of like, okay, let's be friends now and like fix our loneliness, but like, oh wow, you're going through this too, like on a deeper kind of like psychological level, like, oh, you're in some way like similar to me, you kind of know what I'm going through. And the thing that stops people from doing that maybe is a fear that they'll kind of be rejected for that, as opposed to like embraced kind of for their for their insecurity. So I think that's part of what I see in a lot of settings, like when people are not fully authentic, maybe it's like you can be scared that your authenticity is instead of bringing you closer to someone, it's going to be the reason that like someone does not value you, and then that probably goes back to totally that sense.
I mean, that totally makes sense, connecting to like what we see and what we experience, especially in this area. Like if we're seeing people presumably connect so much on their shared values or identities, and like, wow, whether it's social media and like the inflammation of that, or the fact that there's just so many flippant people in the Bay Area. And like, can you talk more about how that connects to living in Silicon Valley? And this term you call crowded loneliness.
I think, I mean, it goes back. So I grew up in Palo Alto, went to, you know, Pali High, which is right across from Stanford. And I think that actually touches my experience and the experiences of my peers there, touches directly to both the kind of ideal versus reality question, and then also the kind of insecurity, vulnerability, separating people kind of question, which is that, you know, growing up in the area, for example, there's this kind of weird ideal construct you have of, you know, everyone is hyper smart, hyper successful, hyper kind of desirable in some way. And, you know, you kind of, you see so many people who are smart or successful or desirable in some way. And you see enough of them that, again, you kind of start to build up this construct in your head of like, that is what it means to kind of be here and to belong here. And so you have this ideal, and then you compare it to yourself and you realize you don't fit this kind of, you know, cookie cutter construct, because you are not, maybe you're smart, but you're not, you know, successful, or maybe you're successful, but you're not super athletic, you know, on the high school sports team or whatever. And so that contributes to the kind of sense of alienation or kind of separation. And then, you know, and then it also propagates itself in that, because like kind of strength and success are so valued, you're incentivized against kind of revealing your insecurity, your kind of brokenness, the ways in which you don't match up, because you feel like everyone else matches up. And so that propagates loneliness, and it's a very well, you know, documented and pretty, pretty sad history, you know, particularly in this community, of that really having, pretty negative effects on kids' mental health, on, their senses of belonging. And obviously that's such a complicated, topic, but definitely it contributes, you know, to a lot of like tensions, anxieties.
So you grew up here in Palo Alto, then you went out east, then you came back
a little bit.
Can you talk about how your like sense of belonging has changed, your connection to Palo Alto?
That's been a big, that was like one of the stark contrasts, I think, was like my feeling of like the area when I left after high school, and my feeling when I came back to work kind of for a couple of years, throughout like growing up and throughout high school, even though you had maybe those feelings of you were aware of the ways in which the kind of culture was not super conducive to like people's belonging or people's right. like sense of like really being like known for who they are. Mm-hmm. There was still like a very much like a glorification, you know, of people like this is the place to be, you know, this is like, well, Google's here and like, you know, Stanford's across the street. And like, you know, all this stuff's happening, like, wow, this is where, you know, if you can make it back here when you're an adult and you can raise a family here, like you've made it.
Wow.
And everything. And that was a lot, you know, even as people were struggling with like, you know, a lot of people struggling with the kind of mental health or different
yeah.
things like in high school, I felt like that was a kind of pervading notion. And mm-hmm. it's funny because nowadays, both myself and pretty much everyone I talk to from like high school days is at the very least very ambivalent about like the area and the culture
okay.
and at
yeah.
worst, like, get me away from here and like I'm never coming back.
Wow.
And I think part of that's because, you know, most of us kind of went away to college
mm-hmm.
and even though, you know, various colleges have their own pernicious kind of tendencies and everything, depending on where you're at, people were able to kind of see that what was painted as a kind of like ideal of this is the way that you can feel like good and successful by achieving, by having a high kind of, you know, academic or social status, by getting a lot of money, whatever. I think they went away and found kind of more maybe genuine relationships or genuine passions, you know, in their,
yeah.
in their like studies and whatever. And they were like, oh wait, no, this is actually what kind of makes me feel like I belong and feel good.
Yeah.
And then you come back home and you're like, you know, people just aren't talking about maybe the things that that would bring that real sense of belonging, like their vulnerabilities and their kind of weaknesses and whatever, like those, you know, big picture ideas of how do we actually like really, you know, help people and make other people feel like they belong as opposed, because, you know, there's this big kind of like, oh, we're changing the world kind of thing, whether it's like tech startups or it's the university itself. But there's a really, you know, just read Brothers Karamazov by Dostoevsky, and there's a funny scene where this physician talks about how the more, you know, he's a doctor, he's kind of has these ideals of medicine, whatever, and he's saying like the more he loves and falls in love with like serving humankind and like mankind, the more he hates humans in general or like in specific. So he has this like great idea of like,
too relatable.
Like, you know, I have this like great ideal of serving people, and then like an actual person comes into the office and they're just complaining about things, and you can't wait to like get them out.
So they're not fitting the ideal that could be.
So I think that's been kind of part of my feel.
That's really interesting. So I like how you brought up this glorification of Silicon Valley and Stanford too, very much situated in there. And let's talk more about that in a minute too. But for you, like, was it that you were able to leave and come back with a different set of lenses? Or like, has it gotten worse? Like Silicon Valley and its like image.
It's a mix of a lot of things. So definitely like in college, you know, even the people who know me best, whether it was like my high school friends, even my college friends, you know, my sisters or whoever, will definitely say that like I was like almost unrecognizable from when I was beginning college and even from like the middle of college, you know, to now.
What was the biggest changes, like, me only knowing
Old Dallas was not, like, you know, there was a lot of similarities in terms of, like, the kind of goofiness and just the ability to kind of, like, lock into something, like, namely basketball at the time. I was much more, I think, invested in trying to fit, again, certain like ideals of what I thought it meant to really be kind of like doing the well-lived life. So I was like, you know, I think I was really focused on, you know, being the best, you know, basketball player, or you know, focused on, you know, kind of how like attractive, you know, I'm looking or in one way or another, and portraying this sense of like being very, you know, having a lot of friends, being very popular and whatever. And it took actually the kind of end of my basketball career in junior year of college, and then some kind of like some medical stuff I was going through to really like reorient myself and start asking questions of, again, like, what do we find to be the core of like our identity and value? What, like, what is really stabilizing us, especially when the things that typically, you know, make people feel really good about themselves are challenged. So something like an identity, like a basketball player, or say, you know, say like a grad student, or you know, this, or, you know, so even your physical health. So how do you find like that both more stable, but then also more fulfilling sense of identity? Because I also looked back on things like, you know, relying on sports to give you a sense of value, looked back and saw that it was not like, as long as I was playing, I felt like I had value. It was like, if I was playing well, I felt like I was like very good, and I'd be very social and like kind of ebullient. And if I played poorly, you kind of withdraw, I'd withdraw into myself. Because I feel like, oh, you know, I can't, you know, there's, I can't kind of, it's almost not justified to like be super happy while I'm kind of sucking in this way, you know. So after that experience, I really came back in with a much more kind of calm and I think humbled lens, looking pretty skeptically at notions of, you know, if you're doing well, then you're really happy. And then looking, you know, it's, I don't want to paint like kind of Palo Alto or Silicon Valley as like this like evil empire thing that's going on, but
what's really going on?
Yeah,
there are issues though.
I think the ways in which it changed, it's tough to say again because I guess like my relation to it has inherently been dependent on where I am in my own life. From what I hear from other people who have been here a long time, and what does cohere in my experiences is that, again, if you go back decades, you know, to like this area, there was a kind of almost like hippie feel to it, like very homey kind of family area. And you see a lot of people who are like longtime residents who kind of will like decry the sense that that is not so much there anymore. It's much more transient where people are coming and leaving. And,
very fast paced.
Fast paced. Yeah.
Lots
so,
of people live at work.
That's actually a funny thing too, is I like prepare to go to the East Coast where, you know, the conception is like people are super, you know,
on time
and like, you know,
they're never five minutes late.
They're kind of driven and whatever. and there's a weird perception that like, oh, but here in the Bay Area, it's like people are super chill and like whatever.
That's interesting.
Yeah. But like my experience of it is maybe on the very, very surface level, but like really pretty much everyone I know around here is like, you know, driven like a machine in terms of like, okay, like got to do this, and like go here. Like no one has, you know, everyone here is as crunched on time as anyone in New York City, probably, you know.
Yeah.
But it's just, it manifests differently.
Yeah. Do you think there's a subconscious need to put up the portrayal of like, we are
laid
back and...
Yeah. And that's why, you know, like, obviously a lot of people at Stanford are familiar with the kind of like, whatever, duck syndrome thing. But that was actually a thing that I was really, you know, one of the reasons I was not particularly... apt to work that hard in school, in high school, was because, again, going to, like, growing up here, academic success, and, like, not only academic success, but just kind of, like, the portrayal of, like, brilliance almost was such a kind of standard for are you meeting the criteria for, like, really being kind of admirable in this area or desirable, that I was scared of falling short of that standard. So, you know, the two reactions you can have are, I'm just going to work super hard to meet that. Or the safest way to actually do that is say, I'm just not going to try at all. And then if I do end up not doing well, say in my classes, then I just lean back on the excuse like, hey, I didn't even try. And I'm like the cool kid who like, oh, you guys are trying super hard.
I could have.
Yeah, exactly. And then if you do well, then you're like, wow, I'm way more brilliant than any of you because I didn't even try and I did well, you know? So it's like a foolproof thing that's actually, but in the paradox of it is that, as in regards to like working around that standard of like belonging, in that setting, it's kind of foolproof, but then actually it's like the least fulfilling thing you could possibly do because you're not actually like devoting yourself and you're not, it's not very fulfilling.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. So as you prepare this summer to head off to Harvard for medical school, you're preparing to like spend some long winters in the East Coast.
Yeah.
How are you feeling about the next chapter and how is your concept of home evolving to you personally?
Yeah. In the first sense, I just feel very excited, and I don't think I have a ton of illusions about, I don't have this kind of like dream fantasy that it's going to be this fantastic thing that's always super joyful.
right.
But I do know that I will kind of be pushed in a certain way, challenged in a way that excites me, and just learning is very I think central to my feeling of engagement with the world and everything. But also very excited by the idea that I will be in a setting where kind of I can, again, think, apply like what I'm learning and what I'm doing in a kind of bigger picture way that extends beyond just like my trying to reach for like status or whatever. So in particular, like, you know, trying to expand my writing work in a way that is able to continue to bring about these discussions of like identity and value through stories of like, you know, illness and medicine. And then as pertains to my sense of kind of like home and belonging, home is an interesting kind of concept, because I think it's a blend. Like when I think of belonging, I think of a kind of mix of, again, like being known, like you're in a setting where, both the people around you have an accurate or authentic view of who you are. Like you're not, they don't have this like kind of fake mask that you've put on.
Yeah.
And then you also know the surroundings really well. So you know the physical surroundings, you're comfortable with them. You also know the people around you. And then there's also a sense of like in belonging still, there's still a sense of coherence as well, where you feel like the setting you're in, it enables you to kind of, it coheres with your values, or it enables you to do what you're trying to do in life. So
that's an interesting
concept. So like, for example, in my work, like as a research assistant, there were definitely periods where I very much did not feel like I belonged, not because of any identity thing, but because, I felt that, going back to that idea of like learning and being challenged in new ways, I felt like I wasn't, in that setting. And because, I felt like the setting was not conducive to my goals and values at the time, I just could not wait to get out because I felt like I did not belong there anymore.
Yeah.
I needed to kind of get out. So when it comes to belonging, I think of like, being known and knowing what's around you, and then the setting facilitating like your goals and your values. Home is a bit different in that, because I think there's also a sense of like consistency and history tied to it. Like, like when I come home, it's like my physical home, you kind of like breathe this like, relaxing breath, because you're like, oh, I'm here. This is, I have all these kind of memories here, and it's solid, consistent. So in that sense, I think I won't immediately definitely, like, I don't look at Boston as my home. And I spent like 2 days, 3 days there, maybe total. But I very much feel like I belong there. Like, that's where I need to be. And maybe in time that becomes home. But I think for me, like, belonging is enough at the moment.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. So then where is home going to be next year?
Yeah. Yeah.
And the more sense that like, oh, it's where my family lives.
Yeah. And this is where it comes back, maybe a bit full circle to, like, the beginning of this conversation where we were talking about kind of, like, forming, you know, your identity and the kind of social circles you run in and everything.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, home won't necessarily be, other than physical home or families and stuff, won't really be Palo Alto again because... I think it's more kind of built out of, maybe it's just too cliche or something, but it's kind of like, it's almost like an internal thing, like you kind of have to carry with you, because ultimately, like, you know, when we're doing these, like, deep reflections and thinkings, what we do is we tend to, like, almost recoil into, like, an inner world of sorts, right? Mm-hmm. Where, you know, you're less aware of, like, time passing and you're less aware.
External stimuli.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And you're almost, like, engaging, like, a dialogue, like, with yourself as you, like, reflect on topics. And that is sort of, like, the base home that you kind of have to be most comfortable with is, like, you know, am I living a life, in a way that is consistent with who I think myself to be? Do I feel like I'm split between, like, you know, multiple selves? Or do I think that I'm, like, I have these values, but I'm not living them out in a certain way? And I think, like, the more and more, like, internally that you feel you're not super consistent or you feel you're split, like, no matter where you are, I think it won't feel totally like home because...
Yeah.
You won't even have that internal, like, consistency to have that, you know, external consistency that I mentioned earlier.
Yeah.
So I think for me, home will be trying to feel like I'm not, again, like, compartmentalizing my life into, like, pockets I have to jump between. But, like, as long as kind of I'm in my own head, that's a space where I feel that... what I'm thinking and what I'm doing makes sense and coheres with the stories I tell myself about who I am and what I've done and what my values are. And then from that, you know, then from that you can start to, as you find other people who kind of have similar stories or similar values and whatever, you can start to build kind of communities out of that. And you have similar joint projects with people, and then, you know, maybe you find, like, a physical sense of home amidst those people as well. But I think it's an internal thing too. Yeah,
that's super cool. Yeah, so you and I are both Christians, as we mentioned earlier, and I know a lot of our listeners have different worldviews, but I'm wondering if you can dig in a little bit more to that. As a Christian, what does forming that sense of home mean, and can it fully exist here in the physical world?
Yeah. Good questions. Forming that sense of home, part of it, and I'll definitely do my best to avoid any kind of, like, weird, you know, religious jargon. I think a big part of it goes back to, a large part of it goes back to kind of when, especially when you bring in the kind of faith aspect and this idea that they're, you know, your, like I said, like the stories you tell yourself, the stories of, like, your own life and your values. When you see those as part of a bigger story and, like, a bigger kind of set of values, I think an important part of feeling, like, at home is kind of, like, am I where I'm quote-unquote supposed to be, or where I'm, like, do I feel called to kind of be here. Mm-hmm. And that's like, I guess, a kind of tricky concept. And goes back to like the alignment of like both your internal kind of passions and desires like for your life, and then also like the external workings of your life. So, you know, what's happening in your relationships, what's happening in your career, does it make sense for you to be where you are and to be doing what you're doing? So I think, like, for example, like going to the East Coast and everything, it very much feels like that does cohere, and that is a kind of like sense of home that can be constructed, a sense of home, not only like internally, but within kind of like my faith worldview, where, again, I've been thinking a lot of like, say, as a Christian, like my call, what I really feel to be a calling, to be like serving others on a large scale as it pertains to like, you know, uplifting the kind of the oppressed or, you know, the poor and whatever. And I see, you know, Harvard and that whole, you know, and that Boston area as one area where I can start to leverage maybe platforms and connections and skills to have those like larger impacts. You know, being in a city, being in a city with as much kind of complexity as Boston as it pertains to, say, you know, racial inequality, socioeconomic inequality, healthcare inequality, things like that. And again, that being so immersed in something that makes sense to my view of the world and my obligations within the world, that constructs already, even though I'm not even there yet, it constructs like a feeling of like, I am going to where I need to be, where I'm called to be. But, you know, can we put together like a perfectly, you know, especially as a Christian, can I put together like a really manifest sense of things are as they should be here physically on earth? You know, I don't think that ultimately that's something that's kind of like that we strive towards, but we don't, you know, we never manifest it perfectly. And that goes back to that whole sense of like, as long as, you know, we're still doing this regular day-to-day thing in the day-to-day world, we can't expect fully our ideals to actually manifest, you know, in a very imperfect, non-ideal world. That doesn't mean that we throw away our ideals and we say, you know, that doesn't mean we go become like, you know, Stoics and say, actually, what I desire is just the world as it is. Like, whatever the world is, I desire it to be that, and therefore I have what I desire. Yeah. We don't kind of throw away our ideals, but we're willing to sit in some of the kind of messiness and uncertainty, and hold on to them, even, but not be kind of crushed when they aren't necessarily realized. So basically, I think for me, a sense of home, getting to that place where I really feel like I kind of belong and am known and, you know, coheres with my values. That's definitely, I feel like I'm moving in that direction, but I also don't expect that I'm going to one day sit down and say, it all fell into place and like, I'm so good here. That actually has to come, like I said, has to come from a more like internal sense of, okay, especially as a Christian, like I am kind of fully known. There is like a God who kind of fully sees all my kind of insecurities and difficulties and loves me in the midst of that. And then is also, you know, empowering me to, you know, do the things that he kind of puts on my heart as in line with my values, like working for, you know, for the poor, for people who are suffering through like the loss of their health and their identity. And that will be like that sense of closest home, I think. Mm-hmm. And the kind of call in that case will be to bring that internal sense, not to kind of like bring home like out of nothing, right? And to just like create, construct like a home from like our physical, you know, like brick and mortar, but to first like find in kind of internally, and again, it sounds like really, really cheesy for some reason, but like to find internally a consistency and a conviction that like that you belong and that you're here, and that there's like a beauty and a joy, like a meaning to things, and then just trying to like take that, what's like inside you, and just show it to other people through your actions and through your interactions, your social interactions, and then your work. And then, you know, hopefully you build communities that are surrounded by those same ideas.
Yeah, awesome. Yeah, if the whole world was like
that. Yeah, I don't know, yeah.
Yeah, that's the calling, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's super cool. I really want to talk about suffering a little bit.
Yeah, yeah, I love suffering.
<That's really> great. and I'm super interested in hearing your perspective as someone who's read and thought a lot about human suffering as it pertains to health. But, yeah, like, what are some of the goings-on in your mind right now in your construct of suffering? What does it mean? Like, what is suffering, really?
Yeah.
At its base level?
Yeah.
And how does that connect to our context? So not just the medical context, which you'll have a lot to say, but what is suffering in the university look like?
Yeah.
What is suffering in our culture and society and America right now look like? What is, what does it mean to be a sufferer?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good kind of qualification you made about, like, you know, me thinking primarily, you know, in terms of the contexts that have been most closest to me, like like medical illness, people I've worked with, and end of life care and stuff. You know, I don't know a whole lot about what it means to suffer, because, you know, like the people, like children at these kind of border detention camps are suffering, right? That's something I don't know a lot about. But in the regards that I have seen, I think it's a consistent kind of some of the themes I've seen, and again, the people I've talked to, and the things I've read, and looking at my own kind of experiences where I felt like I was, for some reason or another, suffering. There's the most baseline kind of component of it is a kind of, you know, you have this desire of the way you think things ought to be, of like this, again, this ideal world. And then you have like a reality of the way things actually are, that is in some sense like less than or a broken version of that ideal. And suffering is that kind of like wedge that is between those two like lines, or the angles between those two lines, perhaps. And it's looking at your situation, and it's a sense of both kind of disappointment, or in some cases like despair, of, you know, that causes you to think like, you know, why are things like this, and you know, they could be different, and I want them to kind of be different. And so again, in like in end of life care, the things, you know, that a lot of times can perhaps really people struggle with, or, you know, in medical illness in general, is especially if you've had, like, you know, a life where you've had your health, and you've had these passions, or just this way of like going about the world and just like feeling good and not being in pain, and then all of a sudden something happens, and you know, you're either your mortality is right there facing you, or you're just debilitated, you're disabled in a new way, and you think like, I can't, you know, this part of me, the way I live my life that I really enjoyed for one reason or another, is, it was there and it's not there anymore. And how am I supposed to, you know, have my sense of self, and meaning that I carried, because that was a central part of it. And, you know, I think, I think narrative, like, especially for me as a writer, like, mm-hmm. narrative is an important part of it too. I think a lot about, I work with some people at Stanford in pediatric palliative care. Mm-hmm. And I think about a lot about why, you know, we get particularly affected when we think about like sick children and you know, particularly like say like a dying child or whatnot. And, you know, beyond just the purely like kind of biological, desire to kind of nurture children and everything, like why is that so particularly you know tragic when like a child is ill or is, you know, perhaps dying of terminal illness? And the thing I think I come back to is that, you know, we have these ideas of, we say things, say if like a child kind of passes away early, we say things like, oh, you know, they had their whole life ahead of them, right? They had all these things that they wanted to do or that they were going to do and that they're never going to be able to do. And there's this kind of like future narrative that we feel like should have happened, right? And like that ideal world, like this ought to have happened and it didn't, and something's wrong with that. So I think when I look up, when I look at other people kind of suffering, when I try and think about how I'll continue to try and help people in that regard, it will have to be a way in which, you know, you help people within the current state of things, within like, again, that imperfection, that brokenness, the difference between that ideal and the reality, helping them kind of find a way to see things, or not, you know, I don't want to, again, make it sound like super like self-help book or kind of, you know, weird cheesy thing, but like being able to see and feel a sense that they can still have like the value and meaning and joy even if their ideal is not like achieved, right? That there's something deeper than something that's deeper than their ideal, that is still very much there and is not just like a kind of internal fabrication or a story that they're telling themselves, but it's like really there that they can hold on to.
Yeah, that's interesting. How does that connect to why you chose medicine?
Mm-hmm.
What is the big why for you?
Yeah, that, I mean, that really was the big why. I mean, what originally got me interested in medicine was kind of like, you know, dumb jock, you know, like, oh, the human body's really cool, and I'll be like, you know, it was kind of a fascination with like the musculoskeletal system, basically. Mm. But again, like in middle, late college, where I really started to have my own questions of like, what actually is like my, what is like holding me together, kind of like, what is my identity? Like, what could actually give me joy if like tomorrow I were to just like lose all motion, all movement of my body, and like was to fall like mortally ill or something.
Right.
Which is a super fun thought experiment. That, you know, it's hard to give any one answer to that question without just sounding unbelievably kind of cliche. And so I want to try and do that. But
because it sounds like, you know, one might imagine alleviating suffering could be one calling.
Yeah.
But also knowing from your writing work, it's also like diving into suffering.
Yeah. And so that's a really good point. I think when it comes to like the why of, you know, medicine and stuff, I think a big portion is that, there is something so universal, regardless of how you are suffering, again, whether it's medical illness, poverty, whatever, there is something so universal about that wedge between how the world ought to be and how the world actually is, that when kind of people recognize that other people are suffering too, that's actually, going back to the idea of belonging, like that's actually kind of its own belonging, right? Like part of the reason why, you know, suffering, like suffering through loneliness again, for example, part of the reason why that's so difficult is because it can kind of convince us, your suffering can kind of convince you that you are like you were kind of less, you belong less in the world, right? Like, say if you had, I don't know, if you had like a amputation or something, and you feel very, that your body is just like no longer what, you know, it ought to be. You feel very different from everyone else. You feel like your suffering has kind of separated you from people and you don't belong anymore.
Wow.
But what if we can kind of lean into our sufferings and see them not as like categorical differences we have with people, but existing on a spectrum that we all sit on, that we all like suffer through insecurities and different things. And by like sharing our sufferings with one another and seeing the common themes that run it through them, actually those sufferings can be a route to belonging. And I think going back to also like the Christian thing too, this is where like, you know, this is where that whole idea, you know, in like the Christian doctrine of, you know, say like our deepest belonging coming through like
sharing
the suffering. Of a person, right? That is, I think,
Jesus.
Yeah. that is such a resonant chord. And so, again, when I was going through my various struggles with, like, what, you know, am I still, like, unique and valuable and special? If I don't have this aspect of my identity that I had before, like, the moments where I felt most powerfully, like, healed in that, and most powerfully, like, I felt the deepest sense of joy was when I would did a lot of reading at the time, and I would read, you know, essays of other people, whether they were, like, you know, former athletes who also had, like, gone through a similar process, or just people, again, who suffered through medical illness, and there was a common theme that I started to pick out, which was, namely that, namely that there, the things that people thought were kind of holding them together, you know, fell apart in one way or another, but they were still standing. And in realizing that, and in finding and in exploring that, they actually realized that their belonging, their like value, joy in this world was not contingent on, you know, something like, what is your value to this company or to this like university? And so that's what I want to bring into like medicine, which is, you know, when you're medicine and writing, which is like when you're, you know, talking to a patient, you know, like oncology is, for example, is one of the fields I'm very interested in. And say, you know, talking to maybe like a mother who's facing a pretty difficult cancer prognosis or something. And, you know, you're not going to come to them and say, but it's okay because, you know, you can find something deeper and that's gonna hold you through or whatever. But, you know, can you through your kindness and through your kind of stabilizing force of like compassion and dedication to them, show them that even though they are ill and suffering and tired, and that they in no way are in a state of like, you know, maybe are in no way be in a state of contributing to the world because they're suffering through their illness so much, that, you know, they're still this person who loves them so deeply and recognizes them, even though, like, as their physician, they might have been previously a total stranger to them, that they can say, huh, you know, if even at my, like, lowest low, I can still be, like, so clearly, like, valued, not just as, like, a patient in this, like, medical system, but as, like, a human being, then maybe what I thought was holding me together was not actually the thing that was holding me together. And that's like a super profound realization, because then you're like, wow, you know, what if I, you know, what can really break me down, you know, if I can find that like deeper something, I don't know.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Thanks.
No problem.
Yeah. So I wonder if we could, usually we open our conversations with a couple more, laid back questions.
Sure.
So just for y'all, we just finished drinking some tea.
Yes.
I think, is it gone?
Yeah, I have a little bit more.
I have a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
So today I'm drinking Lady Grey tea. No, Blue Lady Grey.
Blue Lady Grey.
Yeah, so it's Earl Grey, but it has blue flowers in it.
Mm. That's lovely.
Which is awesome.
Yes.
Yeah. And did you get the Honeybush Organic?
Yeah, it smells like rooibos, so
yeah.
I dig it.
Yeah, it's very cozy. Awesome.
Mm-hmm.
So, what did you learn at school this
week? Yeah, so I'm, for listeners out there, I'm like living a fake existence for like the next 4 weeks before medical school. I'm just like devouring. I still wake up at like 6 a.m. and go running. But
wow,
then
goals.
Yeah, goals. But then I just like lay back and read, just trying to devour as many books before I just start like having textbooks shoved down my throat.
Right.
So I was reading, my two big like genres right now are just like classic literature,
mm-hmm.
and like novels and like intellectual histories. So I've been very interested in like trying to, I'm in kind of a period of trying to really understand my beliefs, both in regards to like, you know, my religious faith and then also just my, you know, my political views and whatever, and see how the ideas that seem to play a part in my life, how they have like evolved or played a part in people's lives over the course of history, right? And like, you know, did they pop out, you know, kind of from a certain place,
yeah,
or whatever. So I'm finishing up along the intellectual history side. I'm finishing up a book by this 20th century kind of political theorist, Hannah Arendt.
Mm-hmm.
She's like a German woman who left, you know, during World War II, essentially. She's mostly a political theorist, but then she wrote this series of works on like the philosophy of the mind and everything.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, but she's, you know, a German,
deep,
like,
yeah.
The German philosophy is like really like, at least at that time, like super idealistic and like very abstract and whatever. So
okay.
A lot of it's like, you know, I just feel like I'm in a weird tornado. But one of the I think interesting things I've been thinking a lot about as I think about thinking is just this way that the interplay between like our internal discourse,
yeah,
we have with ourselves and what happens when we like, again, it's all very metaphorical, but what happens when we like look inwards and start thinking inside ourselves, and so that being one kind of bucket,
mm-hmm.
and then the other bucket when we're just like very cognitively thinking about like the day-to-day objects before us. So
mm-hmm.
like when I look at, you know, just across the table at you at this conversation, or I like contemplate like a tree and it's right in front of me and I'm thinking about it, or like scientific data,
mm-hmm.
where like I'm reading, you know, just
yeah.
making like common sense connections between like, okay, this data point
yeah.
says this and that.
Okay.
And, you know, again, which is basically similar to like the ways in which like our ideals somehow like kind of relate to like the sensory input we get from the world outside us. So, right, we have this kind of idea maybe that, you know, we can kind of like conjure up, you know, our ideal of like justice, or conjure up, you know, our ideal of like the perfect person, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like say the perfect like life partner.
Right.
And we feel like, you know, this is the kind of like
mm-hmm.
idea we've had, and we've kind of built it up, you know, in our heads or whatever. But I think it's important, like for me, it's just interesting to now think about how it's not like those are, you know, those are ideals that were like reached by this like perfect otherworldly like logical thinking. It's not like a mathematical proof,
mm-hmm.
right? Where we think about math in terms of like
yeah.
kind of these like self-evident
yeah.
like axioms that are not dependent on like what's going on in the day-to-day world,
yeah.
right? It's a like kind of pure logic,
right.
But
and you can like mathematically define
yeah.
the discrepancy between
mm-hmm.
ideals,
yeah, yeah,
and reality,
yeah, yeah. But when it comes to like our ideals,
yeah.
you know, those might not be perfectly logical in the sense that, like, mathematical proofs are logical because,
right.
you know, and again, in asking, like, what's the perfect, like, life partner look like, you didn't just, like, start with these, like, you know, geometric axioms of, like, oh, and therefore this, I have this perfectly logical view of the perfect person. What you did, like, your internal thinking, even though it's, like, in abstract concepts and it's in your head, it's, like, you needed real-world kind of examples of it first. So, like, you were, like, instead of trying to come up with the axiom of, like, okay, the perfect person is clearly, like, this, you know, they're very attractive and they're very kind because attractiveness and kindness are, like, the good things, right?
Right.
You looked at people who you were, like, that seems like someone who I, you know, like to be a life partner with or whatever, and
right.
they're, like, all these different people who have these different characteristics.
A lot of, like, training data.
Yeah,
like
exactly.
AI-speak.
And then
yeah.
you put together, like, a composite version of that in your head.
Mm-hmm.
But again, the trouble with, like, starting to worship, not, you know, there's kind of like a kind of, there's my Christian kind of jargon coming in. The problem
by
with,
worship,
yeah,
yes,
like,
or
elevate, the problem with, like,
idolize,
elevating,
yeah,
idolizing that ideal is
yeah.
it's, like, it's neither a perfect, like, mathematical, like, logical proof in that it didn't start with, like, these self-evident, like, axioms,
yeah.
nor is it a perfect representation of, like, actual day-to-day reality because, like, you didn't actually see that perfect person, but you're kind of doing, like, a half and half.
Yeah, and they may
right?
not exist.
Exactly, and that's
yeah,
why,
exactly.
that's why, like, neither is that ideal perfectly logical, nor is it, like, perfectly representative of just, like, your sensory input. So, but that doesn't mean it's totally invalid, but the thing you should realize, the thing I've learned is, like,
yeah.
I should realize that this is only, like, a very general, like, guiding, you know, example. I cannot take this to be, like, the thing I'm looking for. This goes back to, there's this painting, French painting of a pipe, right? A smoking pipe, and underneath it, it just says, this is not a pipe. It's a picture of a pipe, right? It's not an actual pipe, and so that's something to remember, like, when we think about our ideals, whether it's the perfect life partner or, like, perfect justice or, you know, friendship or whatever, like, you know, there are different ways, there are different threads that contribute to our definitions of these things.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Awesome. There.
Awesome.
This
cool.
great.
Yeah.
yeah.
Thank great.
You so much for
Thank you.
Coming on
yeah.
the pod.
Thanks for listening to Life, the University, and Everything, a podcast of mostly academics brewing, sipping, or spilling tea. Subscribe to the show on iTunes, Spotify, Google Play, or other places that you get your podcasts. If you like the show, leave us a review on iTunes, and also let the universe know on the socials. Follow us on Instagram and Twitter at LUE Podcast. Submit questions for our not advice section to lifetheuniversityandeverything@gmail.com. Life, the University, and Everything is produced by E.B. Dresser Clutchman and, you know, thermodynamics and stuff. I'm Kat Gonzalez. Tune in next time.